Hello, everyone. Before we get into the big goodbye review, I just wanted you to know a couple things. This was the one TNG episode that Brian Baker had shipwrecked on the Shipwreck Trek as a part of Ten Forward podcast, which is on the Trekmate Family Network. I did not know Brian had shipwrecked this episode when we were doing this, or when we were preparing for this, but I do want you to know that he did his shipwreck trek a couple days before he died, and I had a hard time listening to it because it was so emotional for me, but I was so thankful I did. I will have a link to Brian's shipwreck trek so that you can listen to it and see what it is he said about the big goodbye. And perhaps maybe you could stop listening to this now, listen to that one, and then come back here to listen to how we felt about the show. But we had went on without Brian, of course, and the next episode that we will be doing is Data Lore, and that one was going to have Brian on. We had talked one night before about doing the data episodes, and he was planning to come on for this for Data Lore. So next week when you hear Data Lore, we'll be a little more special. But today's episode, The Big Goodbye, was talked about by Brian Baker. Please listen to that. Look for a link on the main page. Thanks. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this star time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. And tonight's episode is The Big Goodbye. I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou, the Cornhusker.
And the synopsis for tonight's show is Captain Picard and some of the Enterprise crew get stuck on the holodeck on their way to an important diplomatic mission. This is 12th episode of Season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date was the 11th of January 1988. It was written by Tracy Tormey and directed by Joseph L. Scanlan. Guest stars tonight include Lawrence Tierney as Cyrus Redblock, Harvey Jason as Felix Leach, William Boyett as Dan Bell, David Selborne as Waylon, and Armanac as,
yeah, I think.
Armanac as McNary. So, what did we think about this episode? Now, this is the first holodeck episode, and actually it's the first holodeck gone wrong episode as well. And I think this doesn't, it comes in not bad, in my opinion. I think there's, the holodeck probably gets a bit of hate later on in the season as some of the stuff that gets introduced in this kind of show gets taken to like cliche. But I think in at this point we're still in a, you know, pretty reasonable territory. What about you, Lou? What did you think?
Well, yeah, someone somewhere out there is going to say, really, Lou? Right out of the gate? As far as holodeck episodes go, I like the holodeck. I love the concept of the holodeck. I wish they would have had some successful holodeck stories before they got to the broken holodeck. But biggest question I have is, seriously? Are you freaking serious? Are you kidding me? If something goes wrong, the program will abort and everyone will vanish? Are you freaking kidding me? That's kind of what I think.
It does seem like there's a there must be a class action suit ready to be launched against whoever invented this technology, right?
Right. And you know, I'm going to kind of go for a low ball here. There's a lot of jokes about what would Geordi LaForge have to do on the holodeck because he can't get a girl in real life. And now our minds are all on Geordi right now and what he could be doing in the holodeck. What happens if when Geordi is doing that, the holodeck goes bad? Could he lose a part of himself? I mean,
it's not worth thinking about.
No, it's not. No.
But I think you could come out of the holodeck in a lot worse state than how you entered.
It makes absolutely no physical sense that everyone could vanish if he does something wrong. Slow down, Wes. You could go right past the anomaly. So he has the binoculars on. I know I'm jumping ahead.
Luke. Oh. No. Before we get started, shall we do some feedback from that previous show?
Oh, absolutely. Gosh, I do that every week, don't I?
And it's not and it's not as if we didn't talk about feedback but 5 minutes ago.
That's the Alzheimer's. Okay. I have to, just like Denny Crane, I have to go around saying my name because I'm going to forget it if I don't. Alright, so...
Hi Lou. Hi James. I've just watched Justice and Lonely Among Us and listened to your discussions, so here are a few thoughts. Brief ones, because you cover the episodes in depth, and I agree with most of what you say. Lonely Among Us. I can certainly see echoes of Journey to Babel, but unfortunately there isn't a strong enough Enterprise character to spin the story around, unlike on the original series. That aside, I had to check other 80s TV sci-fi just to see if the prosthetics were really that bad. They were, to be honest. And not only that, the colouring of the mask made them look stupid. Some good makeup design could easily have taken the base mask and made it look far more realistic. Again, we have Prime Directive issues. It seems these two worlds in the same system do not have warp drive, and Enterprise was the only way they had to get to Parliament. So why is the Federation even in the system? Okay, maybe they are acting as a third party, after these peoples were made aware of the extent of the civilization surrounding them. But even then, the crew seemed so unaware of the ins and outs of these worlds, which is just plain sloppy. I did laugh myself silly when Picard shouted down Yar when she was trying to report the missing delegate and the blood. Priorities, Captain, please. Ultimately an awful episode, the worst so far. P.S. The sizzle plot. I totally forgot about that, which speaks volumes. Justice. Okay, I remember this one. I wonder why. Let's begin. Science officer, a scan of the system, please. Any sign of a warp signature or other artifact linked to an FTL drive? No, Captain. Humanoid life with limited industrial development. Okay then, not suitable for first contact. Set course to Starbay 17. Engage. Well that's what should have happened. But again, the writers are not yet sure how to handle the Prime Directive. But put that aside, who dreamt up their useless first contact protocols? The initial landing party seems to have had far too good a time and never asked the important questions in regards to rules, regulations, etc., etc. The very things a guest would need to know. Then they send down the boy. What in the first season so far makes it likely for Picard to authorise Wesley on the first team down after the first contact, especially given the reports and how free and easy the lifestyle seems to be? I had to laugh though. Obviously this type of Eden, full of young, fit men and women, would probably have issued clothing altogether, but syndicated US TV wasn't ready for that, so may do with some skimpy clothing and plenty of oil when required. It was all pretty to look at, whatever took your fancy. But that aspect was painful to watch, in the same manner as the jail scene in Enterprise. It was too forced, and from another age. That said, like you mentioned, once again the story at its core had an awful lot going for it. The positive and negatives of benevolent being, the need to have a society operating within laws that are fair and just, and how a culture deals and dresses another one with very different beliefs and ideals. To sum up, I don't think Lonely Among Us could be saved, but Justice certainly could. And some of its ideas crop up as the series matures. Up next, another Ferengi episode. Not looking forward to it, but I am looking forward to the discussion on the Battle Bridge. Mike signing off.
Feedback supplemental. As requested, a few thoughts on how the society within Justice behaved in terms of being pretty much the plaything of a very powerful entity. Maybe a sentient computer, or some sort of evolved biological life form. Or maybe something totally different. Lou and James, when discussing the episode, asked about how the black and white approach to law enforcement and social order handles the variables and grey parts of a society, but I think the question itself is relevant. I see the planet as being the home of a pampered and cared for group of humanoids, who have pretty much nothing in common with the majority of the populated worlds of the galaxy. They live for pleasure mostly, it has to be said, with each other, but also the simple delights from living in a temperate climate, being well fed, and no strife, as all the things that complicate society elsewhere seem absent. I see Edo as a comparison to a God and Eden scenario, although the people of Edo are fully aware of right and wrong from their own experiences, but also the knowledge of their ancestors, and the laws and punishments in place for those that go beyond what is expected of them. It's an interesting idea. Simply put, do pretty much anything you want, but some areas are flagged and any transgression within those areas at any time could be met with the only sanction, that being death. This makes sense in a strange way if you consider generations of these people have been born and bred to the situation. Given the positives of their world, even considering breaking the law may be a major aberration, and that is why these areas exist. They may simply be there to weed out anyone that has the potential to be, well, outside of an acceptable mode of behaviour. Taken to the extreme perhaps, but we see kids that can inflict pain on animals as being on the start of a slippery slope. Maybe trampling flowers is the first step to raising your fist to the sky and denouncing your god. The question again was posed about children, the disadvantaged, maybe even the elderly, falling foul of these zones, or even the desperate or those with nothing to lose going crazy and killing or maiming, etc. But again, just in my view, I see this world as only being populated by a certain age group. There were young people, but no children, and certainly no elderly or infirm, physically or mentally. That pushes me towards a belief that the God of Edo dictates birth rates, if indeed children are born, because I don't believe pregnancy is a viable option for these people who have such a free and easy approach to sex, unless they are genetically engineered, of course. But more likely, the planet is seeded as and when required. I'm actually getting echoes of Logan's Run, but to a factor of 1,000. Edo was a paradise for the children of the Sky God. Obey and live a life of pleasure and plenty under the benevolent gaze of the All-Powerful. Transgress and be smited. You know, not that much different to some teachings of Earth religions, both old and new, when you come to think about it. But on Edo, there is no question about the consequences of your actions. That sort of clarity over generations will create a utopia, or a dystopia. Mike, signing off. Again.
All right, so let's do some... Give the feedback some justice, what do you say?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And we have, well, it says 7 for justice. Paul did the forum feed before I could. I guess I forgot to that day. And so it looks a little different, but that's fine. First one is from Kieran McDuff. All right. He says, I've always wondered what would happen if someone dropped a hat into a punishment zone. Yeah, that's a good point. Do they kill a hat? The highlight of this episode was clearly when Wesley basically admitted to being a virgin. There are games that I don't quite know yet. Again, he's probably one that uses a holodeck. Oh, come on. With the lack of clothing and abundance of fit people, I'm surprised he didn't spend the entire episode trying to embarrassingly cover up his problem. Anyway, my major problem with this episode, apart from the one raised in this podcast about the Prime Directive and why the Enterprise was dealing with a clearly pre-warp civilization in the first place, was the speech at the end. I'm not taking Wesley whether you... Excuse me. I'm taking Wesley whether you like it or not. No, you're not. Oh, really, shenanigans. Beam out. I honestly heard nothing that Picard would have said to make God change his, her, its mind and let them beam out. Rules need exceptions or there's no justice? How exactly? I've never understood the phrase, the exception that proves the rule. What does he mean by the exception that proves the rule?
That's a well-known phrase over here. Have you not heard of that?
No.
Ah, well, to be honest, I've never quite understood it either. But apparently, if you have something that kind of goes against you know, goes against the general consensus of, and it doesn't have to be, it can be something like a grammatical rule or anything like that. If you have something that goes against it, you'll generally refer to it as the, you know, the exception that proves the rule. Don't know why.
Oh, I've never heard that before. Oh, and that's another comment that we'll have in the future is Ben loves it when you school me. So, the exception that proves a rule means that the presence of an exception applying to a specific case establishes or proves that a general rule exists. Okay, I got it. Yeah, I agree with Kieran McDuff. I don't know how Riker could have persuaded the Edo god simply by saying, when is justice as simple as a rule book?
Yeah, no, that's what Riker says. I'm still of the opinion that that Picard's philosophical like rant at that point is more interesting. But hey.
Okay. Well, all right. So, pre-warp civilization, yes. Okay, yeah, I agree with Kieran. It makes no sense. What about you?
No, absolutely. I think that we kind of cover that in the show.
Yeah. What about if they do drop a hat in the punishment zone?
I think that you better hope that whatever action what are they called? The Edo?
Yeah.
Whatever the action the Edo get down to isn't against the law, I think.
I think what he's trying to say is that first they have sex and then they kill you.
Yes, maybe.
Yeah, that's probably what Kieran's getting at. But I was just also thinking that I suppose as long as if they had thrown the ball into the punishment zone, would anyone have been killed because they weren't in the punishment zone? But, however, if you raise your hand over the punishment zone wall and drop the ball because your hand was in the punishment zone at the time, then you die.
Or at least your hand gets chopped off, right? I don't know. Maybe it's the hand that's responsible there.
Hmm. Well, good point. What about a dog? See, these are things that we didn't think of. If a dog runs pees in the punishment zone...
Death. Immediate death.
Wow. Okay.
But we took a long time debating justice at the time, right?
Oh, yeah.
And there's still more to come out. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what you can do with a 25-year-old episode that's generally considered poor.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's go on to Jarek.
Okay, so Jarek, you said that I'll send in a little audio but now I got the impression that this Eden did not rely on the usual method of propagation. There were no pregnant women, so no need raising the young or educating them. The quote-unquote god of this world took care of that by bringing new people into the community as and when required, and as if this had been going on for hundreds of thousands of years. Then the notion of a society accepting and, yes, embracing the draconian law and its punishment seems reasonable. Hmm. Now, I mean, I didn't get the impression that the kids didn't exist, but I think, you know, that is an interesting observation.
Except for if that was the case, why would there be children at all? I mean, there's no need to have a child grow up if the god can just give them more people. It seems to me that you have to have children to continue, because. I don't really see the Edo god as a god at all, because even it says it understands how the Edo think of them as a god at this stage of their evolution. That to me says the Edo god is admitting that it's not really a god at all.
Yeah, I do really wonder what obviously, there wasn't, you know, time or even, you know, a desire for the writers to pad the backstory, but it is a little interesting about what exactly the relationship between the you know, the quote unquote god was, you know, what their reasons for being there was. It kind of reminds me a little bit like the caretaker that we eventually see that come up in Voyager, where they had a, you know, it was a more explicit relationship that they had with the Akampa, but you know, it could be something similar, right?
Right. Well, I think the caretaker destroyed the Ocampa's world, so he had to take care of them so that the Kazan couldn't get to him. But again, the caretaker wasn't a god. They may think he's a god because of what he does for them. Okay, so my response, which we already touched on before I read my response, this is good point, Jarek. What is interesting is the Edo god really inserts itself into the culture quite often. I think that is what separates it from what we on Earth think of God to be. Our God, if there really is one, never inserts itself and gives us free will. Now, don't take that as me inserting my belief that I might have, but I find it interesting that the Edo God, who really, if you think about it, is just a more advanced life form, drives this culture. Even Data pretty much admits, and I wish I had thought of this while doing the podcast, that the Edo God isn't a god at all, because it understands that Edo worship it as a god and how it's normal at their stage of development. And I have been in arguments with listeners about the whole religion and Trek debates, but this again makes me think the point is to show that Edo are wrong to believe in such nonsense, and will someday figure out the error of their ways. So anyway, pro or con in this episode, the morality play is pretty good, and that's what gives it my rating.
Okay. Actually, pretty good reply there, right? Mm-hmm. You get your own personal reply if you put a post onto the forum. Mm-hmm. Now, Paul from Previously Now quoted a post and says, "Wow, you guys really like Scotsman. Tone unturned this time. I enjoyed your chat better than this episode. This whole premise seems so daft and ridiculous to the extreme." Now, I do have to admit that fundamentally what they had kind of a nexus of an idea that they did take to the extreme in order to analyze it, and I think that's fairly common. Add the confusion over the Prime Directive, and you're left with a pretty bad taste that not even scantily clad women can cover. Lou, I'm pretty sure that no one in Scotland was offended, as kilts are not skirts. When you mention men in skirts, I think more of cross-dressers than Scotsmen. If you want to see lots of kilt action, there's plenty of it in our four-minute women's summary, including some well-known faces from Trekmate. And Paul posts a link to a YouTube clip that he has of his wedding that I believe was just, I mean, I'm going to say it was last year?
Mm-hmm.
I
believe it was. Yes, it was.
I think it's just last... I'm under the impression they just went through an anniversary of some, the first anniversary, but maybe I'm talking nonsense.
Yeah, it's about a four-minute video, so, you know, I'm going to try and put a link to this on the main page. I hope I remember. But, so Lou, when you're editing this, put a link to that video on the main page. Thank you.
By the way, I listen to a fair number of podcasts that do mention, I'm going to try to remember to put a link, and there are never any links,
and I'm just as guilty. Just as guilty. Okay, so anyway, I respond to that by saying, thanks for posting this, Paul. I didn't realize you did before I did another one. Oh, never mind. What I'm saying basically is, thanks for posting the forum. I did another one. He came back with, I wouldn't worry about it. We slag of men in dresses all the time on Previously in the Alpha Quadrant. So, but anyway, okay, that's good. Because as soon as I was thinking about, you know, could I have offended somebody? I thought of Paul, and Paul's a good guy, and I don't want to offend him, so that's why I had to apologize, even if it wasn't necessary. So let's go to Ben.
Okay, so yay. Lou, boy, am I glad you enjoyed this one. I can't say that I'm terribly fond of it, but it has a great Picard speech at the end, which is worth the wait, and I agree with that. I guess this question talks best about justice. Would you rather have every guilty person jailed at the cost of one wrongful conviction of an innocent person, or have every innocent person remain free at the cost of letting one guilty offender go unpunished? No system of justice is perfect, and I think Picard is arguing that when your beliefs are held hostage by the, quote, system, law, and order, the decisions we make will be flawed. Anyhow, another good review, guys. By the way, when this episode comes on, I can't help but hear some Mix-a-Lot singing "I Love Big Butts and I Cannot Lie." I am. Why would that come up? I'm not sure why that would come up.
Well, basically, it's I like big butts. thoughts and I cannot lie. The other brother can deny. When a girl walks in with a pretty little face and Planet Justice is up place, you get sprung.
No, please. No. Don't do that.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, you can finish what he says.
Okay. I slightly misquoted the verse, but you get the idea. Adios.
Yeah, this is a very good question. Would you rather have 10 guilty people go free than have one innocent person put in jail? Well, problem is, there are a lot of innocent people that are put in jail. I mean, how many DNA tests have proven that a person is innocent of the crime? And sometimes that still isn't enough because the other evidence in the case may still have proven them guilty, so therefore some innocent people could still be in jail. So would we rather have 10 go free? Not really. That's a tough one.
And I think this is also comes down to, I mean, on a related issue, right? It's kind of the philosophical question is, you know, is ill by action worse than ill by inaction?
Red alert. This is a computer-generated red alert. The Skype call has been lost. Reconnection complete. You handsome gentlemen may resume the show.
Alright, guys. Well, if we happen to sound different than we did a few seconds ago, it's because the Eden God just slapped us down and my Skype just froze like a popsicle. So I ended up having, and then when I tried to get back on, it said wrong password. And so I had to reboot the whole computer. So now let's carry on to the big goodbye. I'm trying to go to Memory Alpha and get my place back. Okay, so the big goodbye.
Now right at the beginning of this episode, I found it very, it's strange that portraying Picard, right, as he has to put across a message to the what are they called, the Harada?
Yes.
And it's very difficult to speak their language or whatnot. And I don't. There are two things I don't get about this. One, why is it necessary? Why don't they just type out what he has to say phonetically?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a phonetical alphabet out there. You can transcribe whatever he has to say into symbols, and that's it. You don't need to have their funny way of writing.
I got one better.
Go on then.
Why doesn't Data just do it in Picard's voice? It'd be perfect and flawless.
Actually, that was my second point, right?
Oh, sorry. Go on.
Do you need him to do it there? And then I suppose, you know, add a push. If they find out that you faked it, they will be upset with you, perhaps. But then again, if you've gone to the effort of building an android for the sole purpose of reproducing Picard's voice so that you can honor them in their own language, they should feel good.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Dr. Soon did a lot of work, as we'll find out later. Yeah, but you see, the thing is, I guess we didn't know it at the time, but do we ever see the Harada again?
No, I don't think so.
So really, it's a matter of if we like them or not. That's my first note. Whoever the Harada are, do we really need to be friends if they're offended so easily? Who cares who they are? They're not part of the Federation. They're just a passerby. But I guess if we don't honor them in their language and say hello the proper style,
I have to agree, and I don't wish to jump to the right at the end of the episode already, but I am going to. But you know, at the end of the episode, you know, spoilers, when Picard actually makes the greeting, and the aliens say, "Oh, thank you, you've honored us in our language," and then everyone does a round of applause.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who's to say that they don't find that offensive? I actually just thought, yeah, you honor us. Everyone starts cheering. He said, whoa, what's all this about? What is this disrespect you're showing us? Get out! I assume that's how the episode actually ended, just after, you know, after we left the crew.
Yes, but you know what really irritated me? We bounce around here a lot, so if you guys ain't used to that, get used to it. What really irritated me is Data wants to watch the tape of the last encounter with the Harada. Jeez, once you've seen them in action, you don't want to see them again. I felt cheated. I want to see what happened.
Actually, what did you take away as being, you know, what was this, you know, graphically demonstrated? What happens when you offend them? What did they do? I mean, did they kill someone or?
I think the entire ship was probably destroyed. They turned the captain inside out. I don't know. That's what I'm saying. It leaves you to your imagination, but I would love to have seen what would have happened if you piss them off.
But if it is this bad, right? What, you're going to send a flagship back for another try? And you're going to, you know, Picard, who's not a linguist and apparently can't spell knife properly, and you're going to rely on him making the speech. To me, it sounds a rather dodgy plan.
Plus the fact that he's trying to learn the silent E and the long elongated whatever, and you know, he just throws his hands up and says, I gotta get away from this for a bit. So what does he do? Instead of practicing some more, he goes into the holodeck. Where obviously he has some more important things to worry about than Ngong, Glang, Klaxi, Hong Kong, Hong Kong, whatever, and Hong Kong. So, when did he ever find time to study to belt out that saying so easily?
Well, I think he obviously knew it, and he was just getting, you know, over-prepared, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm getting over-prepared, Troy says, go to the holodeck. But, yep, I'm off. Mm. And the point that you made, by the way, right at the, you know, before we went into feedback, about, you know, how the holodeck, if it shuts down incorrectly, it can like wipe out everybody. Now, originally when I saw the holodeck, I always assumed it was just holograms. Mm-hmm. Or at least my thinking for a long time was that it was just holograms. And, you know, holograms and potentially force fields, so then, you know, give you a bit of a thump. But that's all. You know, that's always what I thought it was. And as a result, you know, I can't see how that could go wrong, right? But, you know, once or twice they start introducing this idea about there being also transport technology in there as well. And sometimes it sounds like it's supposed to be something beyond just, you know, replicating an apple and then allowing you to eat an apple. So I don't know whether or not there's, like, you know, some type of huge whirly transportery matrix that keeps everything in sync while you're in the holodeck. But to me, that sounds so dangerous. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the what added benefit does it give you to be put in this death trap?
You know, you're right. The holodeck, it seems like a holodeck really is only as good as the story that it's being used for. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. On this one, they shut down the holodeck easily. You know, computer in program, and the music drowns on while we hear. Yeah, so why does it take so long to get Fairhaven to shut down before the computer gets all screwed up? I mean, they have a cloud or something coming at them, and we have to shut the computer, the holodeck down, but we don't have time to go through its normal shutdown routine. Why?
I mean, the only thing that I would say in defense of the holodeck is that, I mean, fundamentally, if you think of it as like a computer, what you're asking here is, you know, why does Windows Vista take longer to shut down than Windows XP? Mm. Or, you know, on any given day? So ask me, you know, maybe it is like that. But what is your opinion about holodeck stories in general, Lou?
I love the idea. I think when I first started doing the Lou Trek Show back in 2009, I came up with the slogan about, and now a guy who, I always have that, and now a man who, whatever. And one of the first ones was, and now a man who's holding on to a spare bedroom just in case they build a real holodeck. I would love to have a holodeck. Can you imagine? I'd take the TV out, the cable would be gone. Or in my case, satellite would be gone, my internet would be gone. I'd spend my time in the holodeck. So the holodeck is a wonderful idea. They don't use it enough, but when they do use it, I kind of got old of the
or I kind of got tired of the holodeck malfunctions every time and people are in danger. When everything around them is fake, the bodies should still be the bodies. So like you say, why is there so much danger? Does the computer take a physical body and turn it into energy, like the transporter? So when you go into the holodeck, are you being converted into energy to be part of the holodeck? Because Tom Paris does his warp 10 jump, he ends up on his butt when it goes bad on the holodeck simulation. So he didn't disappear. It's the holodeck is, I don't know, the way they do it, it's silly.
No, I mean, often in the storytelling, the holodeck is what the holodeck needs to be, in a way. Mm-hmm. No, I do agree, by the way, that in terms of the actual idea of the holodeck, you know, if it were to exist in real life, I think it's fantastic. Actually, Picard mentions how it's used for training and other things, and you don't see that enough. You don't see, you know, the holodeck being used. I mean, I think in Chain of Command, right, they had a bit of a preamble, and they did things there, but it's often recreation and, you know, to a lesser extent, sports and things that they use it for. I think from a story perspective, I think that the idea of the holodeck is very good, but because it's, and what it allows you to do, right, it allows you very easily to set a story outside of the normal confines of the show. So you can go to any planet you like in the universe, you can deal with all of these countless races, and if that wasn't enough for you, you could also recreate anything you like in this world, you know, the past, the future, whatever it happens to be. So I think it's very powerful as a storytelling device. I think, though, that you do, as you mentioned, I think you do rely on holodeck gone wrong stories, you know, more, one or two times too many, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where sometimes people get a bit fed up with it. I actually personally like certain holodeck stories that don't necessarily feature the, you know, holodeck gone wrong, but instead use it as a bit of a jumping off point. So, you know, while thinking about holodeck stories that I enjoy, things like, you know, the Deep Space Nine taking me out to the holosuite, where it's funny, it's a holodeck story, but it's not really a holodeck story. It's just that you're able to have the baseball game within a show that really, without the holodeck, you wouldn't have been able to have that set in. So I think that's a good way to use it. You know, author in Voyager, when the Doctor is able to tell his story and how he views, you know, himself and how people react to him. Again, a good use of a holodeck without them having to rely on holodeck gone bad.
Yeah.
And even when you do holodeck gone bad, and maybe this doesn't quite become holodeck gone bad, but the Voyager episode that I really do enjoy is the Tinker Tailor Doctor Spy one, where actually, is that the one in, that is not the one I'm thinking of. I'm thinking about the one that's in the one that's in black and white, the Captain Proton black and white one.
Yes.
That's not Tinker Tailor, the Doctor Spy.
No, that's
something else.
Tinker Tailor is a race that taps into the Doctor's fantasies. Yes.
Yeah, that's with the photonic cannon.
Yeah, I would love to have seen the photonic cannon.
So I think that they, you know, the holodeck, I think, does get used throughout. And, you know, some of these stories are 14 years in the future, you know, the tail end of Voyager. And I do enjoy them. I would have liked to stay away from this idea that there is an inherent threat in something that fundamentally is, you know, if you reduced it down to today's modern standard, it's nothing more than a computer game.
Mm-hmm.
And when people play Call of Duty, they don't believe that they're going to be shot through the head by an actual person.
Right.
And, you know, that's...
Well, yeah, just like in this episode when Waylon is shot, you know, Beverly starts cheering and clapping and laughing until she sees a blood on his hands. No one...
Oh, no,
thinks...
no. She realized long before that. She was just clapping out of spite.
She didn't like Waylon, huh? Oh, yeah, that makes sense, because she wanted to be alone with Picard, and he decided to add Waylon, and she was highly upset.
Oh, there was a lot of Picard Crusher kind of not too hidden subtext in this episode, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there was. Hey, boss, I want to go. Yeah, can I take a gander? Yeah, they were both upset at that time. But yeah, I like your point about the holodeck. There's some good episodes like The Nth Degree, where the holodeck gets used for Barclay.
No, actually, that's a great point. And what he's able to do there, right? He's very quickly able to do things like prototype and then specking things out. So he uses it as a way of construction. And again, that's something that it's, you know, yes, you could use a holodeck in that way. And I wouldn't have even considered the Nth Degree to be a holodeck story. But in a way, it doesn't happen without the holodeck.
Mm-hmm. Or, so no, you know, he...
Very valid point.
He escapes into the holodeck to escape real life, too. So, and speaking of real life, there's another great use of the holodeck when the Doctor has his family. So, yeah. But it seems like TNG, as we go along, you're going to see a recurring motif. There's going to be three things, recurring motifs in TNG. One is a holodeck goes bad. Two is someone on the crew goes crazy and wants to take over the ship, wants to kill everybody. And three, somebody is going to save the day. So, you know what I'm saying? Oh, and make that four. The ship can be taken over. Wait, that's Voyager. Yeah. But, you know, somebody tries to take over the ship, somebody saves the day, and the holodeck goes bad. So those are a lot of recurring motifs on TNG. So, okay, let's go back to the big goodbye, or this is going to be longer than long.
Yes.
Did you see the woman mopping the floor outside of Dixon Hill's office?
Mm-hmm. Did you? Yes.
At the start, it kind of resembled Janeway. She kind of had a resemblance to Janeway. Take a look at that next time.
Yeah, maybe. I wouldn't want to suggest that you're seeing Janeway in places where she's not there.
No, I'm not suggesting that. It just happens to look like Janeway. Yeah, that's it. Janeway is going back in time, mopping the floor. Her other job didn't work out just well, so because they, you know, Voyager took her away from it, but. So she's going to go back in time and be the woman mopping Dixon Hill's office. So, Picard lost another bet. What the heck? Holo characters are not supposed to see you as you really are. They're supposed to see you as the character. So, why would she see his bellboy uniform?
Well, I think, you know, going back to like how I take this as, you know, a holodeck suggester, you know, the future equivalent of computer games, I reckon it's, you know, I'll give this a pass by just claiming that there's something in the option settings where, you know, you can go from, would you like the characters to interact with you as you are, or in character, and you can just flip between them. So I don't have too much of a problem with that. But you do get different, you know, You often will get different behavior when you reference something back outside of the world. So in some cases, they'll, you know, think you're talking gibberish. In other cases, they'll know their existence as holograms within the holodeck. And it's, you know, it's very much a free-for-all in terms of, it's very flexible, right, in how people choose to choose to take whatever rules there are this week for the purpose of the story.
Okay. Do you buy the idea that Picard doesn't know what Halloween is? With all those children on the ship, they don't do Halloween or trick or treat.
No. I think that we're still young in season one, and there are things that people are trying to trying out, and I think one of the things is that they're trying to disconnect, and in particular in this episode, right, they're trying to disconnect the 20th century as it was from the 24th, and I think the issue about Halloween, not knowing that, when they start talking about automobiles, what's an automobile? And you think, well, you know, in about 10 years, you're going to have one downstairs and you're going to go off on a planet and do a buggy ride on a planet looking for Data's clone. How far away is an automobile from Yago in reality? They're exactly the same thing. So I think they're using this as a way of, you know, keeping a distance between 20th century people watching from the 24th century people, like, you know, behaving fish out of water-ish.
Right. Okay. Let's see here. What else have I got? If you've got something, toss it out.
Oh, yeah. I think that I often think about... Are you allowed to play one of these holodecks in any way that you feel that it's appropriate? So, like, you know, obviously the story here, you know, before the story of the holodeck, you know, the holodeck novel, I suppose, is that you're supposed to be a detective. But can you just choose to be a really, really laid-back detective that does no work? Or can you choose to quit and then go and, you know, go and become a bus driver or something like that?
Sell ice cream.
I never quite understand how, you know, how tightly you have to sit to the path. And I suppose, you know, the analogy is with games these days. Can you, you know, if you are playing Call of Duty, are you allowed to quit and quit the army and go back home and, you know, live a normal life? I mean, the answer is no. So
you have to continue playing. But the difference, hold on, the difference of that is the game is written out, it's programmed to be that way. You can only be in that. Whereas a holodeck, you can choose how you wish to play it.
I think you're certainly given the impression that that's true, right? So it does seem to have, I mean, it's almost as if the holodeck's not, at this stage, certainly when he was asking the program to be loaded, right? He was being very, I want to load San Francisco,
yeah.
You know, 1941 AD, you know, not 1941 BC San Francisco.
Right.
I mean, as if there's any doubt which one you mean there. It seemed to me that it was almost as if the writers were showing you the possible worlds were almost infinite that you could create. So it's almost as if the holodeck can be used to absolutely anything for any reason. And I think later on in the seasons, and certainly I think by the time you get to Voyager with their very specific kind of like holo novel of the year, it almost feels that there's a single program that you play out and you are within the rules of that program, whether it's the Fairhaven program or the Captain Proton program, or it's the one with, you know, when Janeway is the woman looking after those ghastly children.
Oh,
can't remember who they were.
Yeah. Not the Countess. I can't remember what she played. But that's another interesting question I just thought of is, are there rules to using the holodeck? Are there programs that you can or cannot run? What if you decided to play the role of Khan Noonien Singh? Can you do that?
I would imagine that there's stuff that you probably are banned from doing, I would have thought. I mean, if you think about this in terms of, you know, you're working for Starfleet, you know, if you go to work and you're given a PC at work, even if you're given an Internet Explorer so you can look at stuff on the web, you know, there are certain things you just don't do at work.
Right.
And I imagine it's similar with the holodeck. You don't just sit there and set up the, recreations of, you know, genocide and take part in it every other Tuesday to relieve the stress or whatever. I think they would have certain issues to be raised about your psychological standard or something.
Because you can imagine how many crew members on Voyager are going to play the part of 6 of 9 so they can be with 7 of 9.
Yeah absolutely.
I'll be her 6 and she'll be my 7.
And this is, I mean, when Picard goes into the holodeck and then kind of comes back, he seems really excited, right, about the issue. And he's kind of being really, really over the top. And almost as if, you know, so the question becomes, how new is the holodeck? So is it literally that they have only just invented it? Because it seems like Picard's almost as if he's the first person among the crew ever to use the holodeck in this capacity.
I think you're right, because of the fact that when he walks in, he does his captain's log to talk about, obviously he's telling us what the holodeck is meant for, but he's actually telling his log the same thing. Well, if holodeck has been around for a while, he wouldn't need to do that.
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking, then Picard walks through the ship and into the briefing room with lipstick on his mouth. How and why?
Well, it is. He should have noticed that.
Well, I doubt he would have noticed that, but he knew the woman would. Well, then again, does he know that's lipstick or her natural color? I don't know. But here's the thing. What I think, some people say, how come when people, when the two walked out, they disappeared from the feet up? However, when another episode, when someone throws a book out, the book immediately vanishes. Why would Picard have lipstick? And I always assumed that it used, they describe it as it uses a something similar to a transporter. Not quite a transporter, but something similar to the basic working of a transporter. But they also incorporate a replicator in there, which is why you can eat the food. And I think that's why the lipstick is still there, because it was replicated. As soon as it was a hologram until the moment she kissed him and transferred it to him, that's when the computer replicated it and put it on his mouth.
Yes, I agree. I absolutely agree. And that's the position that in my mind, trying to explain all of this stuff, I've got to. It is anything that disappears as it leaves the holodeck is a hologram. Mm-hmm. Anything that stays on has been replicated before you leave. Right. And why some things are sometimes holograms, why some things are replicated, that's when I go back to my excuse of it's a firmware update that has been made. Now, in all of that, I still do not understand why these guys disappear from the bottom up.
Yeah, right.
That I can't explain.
Well, because they had to get out a little bit. But when they were out in the corridor, how was the computer able to maintain the holographic cohesion? They weren't within the sights of the holodeck.
They could probably still see maybe three of the walls, right? Mm-hmm. So if that being, you can probably, maybe they can just, just about project a foot or so out of the room.
Okay. Well, when we get to the Sherlock Holmes ones, you know I'm going to be bringing up why was the fireplace still crackling when the program was halted.
And I'll be thinking of an excuse between now and then.
There you go, you got time. So automobiles are a prime ingredient in teenage mating rituals, huh? I don't know about you, but I remember how many times I tried to get some girl named Janelle when I was 16 to do some teenage mating rituals in my car, but she never would fall for it. It just never worked.
Hey, let me now hit you with a difference between our two societies here. When do you guys generally learn to drive in the U.S.?
At 15, you get a learner's permit, and the laws have changed since I was 15. At my day, you could just walk down, give them your birth certificate and stuff, and then you get your learner's permit. Then you got the next year to learn, and at 16, you go for a driver's test. You got to take the written test and the skills test. Now it's changed over the last 29 years for me to where you actually have to take a written test before you even get your learner's permit. So you could do that at 15 still. You can drive on a learner's permit with a licensed adult in the car with you. And then at 16, you become a licensed. But now it's provisional. For the first year, I think, or two, and this is Nebraska, state of Nebraska. I don't know what Iowa, Colorado, South Dakota, or Kansas is like. But for Nebraska, you get a provisional license for at least a year. And if you screw up that provisional license, they can yank it away till you're like 17 or 18 or something. What about over there?
Okay. I mean, it is apparently you can apply for a provisional driving license when you're 15 years old and 9 months. That's news to me. You can start driving when you're 17.
Oh.
I think that is, yeah, it is 17. That is more my recollection. However, I mean, maybe it's different because of, I kind of grew up in cities rather than out in the sticks. It is almost unheard of for anyone to have a car whilst a teenager.
No.
And the reason why, or even have access to a car as a teenager, and certainly over the last 10 years or so, it is prohibitively expensive to insure your car. We have a requirement to have insurance mm-hmm. on the car. Your car, you'll buy your car for $2,000 or so. Mm. Your insurance will be $5,000 mm-hmm. a year. Mm-hmm. And it fundamentally just stop me, prevents you driving until you are 21 or however old. So often, you know, over here in the UK, we see, you know, we see various, you know, movies and stuff showing, you know, people at high school and they drive to high school and stuff. I've never seen that happen.
Really?
You would not be able to drive to high school. People going to high school are on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just, you know, where I was, but I've always thought this must be a bit of a divide, given that, you know, given that at least the impression is that you guys have, you know, a more motor friendly culture than we do.
Mm. Motor friendly culture. heck, motor friendly culture. Well, yeah, we're the nation of road rage. But yeah, you know, I like yours better. If I had my way, she wouldn't get a license till my daughter's 18. And once she gets that learner's permit, you're right, my insurance is going to tag me big time. So, but as far as her having her own car, no, not for a while. That even at 16, that's not going to happen. But the good thing is, you know, if she still lives at home when I'm retired, then she gets to drive my wife to work. yeah, you want a car? Well, I have a Kia Soul that we just got. It's a 2013, and I figure when we have it paid off in 4 or 5 years, then she probably will get that car as hers, and I'll just get a new one. That's, you know, best laid plans of mice and men, I guess is what it's called, but knock on wood. Anyway, we got to go back to the big goodbye.
Yeah, we should. We should.
Yeah.
Did you find it strange that you had, first of all, you had a 20th century historian on the flagship of, you know, of Starfleet? And even if you, I mean, I don't know what he does all day, but even if you did have the 20th century historian, I can imagine that he's probably not the best person to take into the holodeck. Because again, I'm going to use my analogy to computer games these days. It's like a, you know, it's like settling down and saying, oh, I'm going to play a bit of a, you know, I'm going to play a bit of a Wolfenstein 3D. Oh, I know, I'll bring my history teacher along. I mean, I'm sure that this isn't historically accurate.
Well, I guess if it wasn't for Waylon, Picard would never have realized that Jessica Bradley was just a hologram. That's all she ever was.
Really?
Thank you, Lieutenant Obvious. Yes. So, no, I don't see any reason to bring Waylon along. Why would you want a historian that would tell you what's going on when you can find out for yourself?
It's almost as if when he's, you know, when Picard's thinking, oh, we'll bring that historian along. What's his name? Waylon, yeah. And almost expect him to say, yeah, we need him to die.
Yeah, almost die. Yeah. We needed our century's equivalent of the red shirt to go with us because it could be dangerous. But here's the thing. If you think about it, unless Waylon was completely versed on the Dixon Hill series, he's completely useless. Because he's not there for 20th century. They're there for the fictional world of Dixon Hill. That has nothing to do with real history.
No, absolutely. Of course.
All right. I came up with a good one. Okay. So, the briefing. The Herodon aren't anything we should care about. They're not strategically important. But if we do piss them off, bad things can happen. And again, I wanted to see the video.
No, I did want to. I mean, I quite liked the, the innocent way that Data was pushing that, and he said, "Oh, should we not look at it?" And everyone was kind of saying, "No, Data, don't go there." It's a bit of a chuckle.
Yeah, it is. So we've already speculated a couple things. I have a couple more here. What could have happened in the video? Maybe they pulled the captain's pants down and gave him a big, severe spanking.
So I thought you were going to go into the territory of, you know, go over to the captain and give him a huge wedgie.
Yeah, there's okay, that's yours. You can come up with that. Or maybe they blew in the crew's faces like somebody blowing in a dog's face. You know, maybe that could have been one of the things that happened.
You know, that works with children as well, though.
Mm-hmm.
with babies, anyway.
Now, Data was talking to Geordi in the corridor about why didn't the captain want to see all relevant information on it? Did anyone notice Geordi check out the female crew member that walked by while he was talking to Data? He just kind of glances back at her like...
Now, does Geordi have to check out the crew? I mean, because I assume what he's got here is kind of like the ultimate Google Glass, right?
Oh, yeah.
Does he not have the ability to record everything that he perceives, even if he might not be looking directly at it?
No, I don't think he records. I mean, he doesn't have any enhancements in his brain. That's just so he could see the electromagnetic spectrum.
I would add a little thing just before the information gets passed in. So his little red little dot bleepy thing. Have a little thing that records it for Data.
Oh, yeah.
And I think your point that you're about to raise is that what exactly does he see?
Yeah, could he see right through the uniform like the airport scanner?
Almost certainly.
Yeah, because he only peeks after the hand is over. Yeah. I'll bet. That's interesting. That would be so interesting. You'd have a hard time seeing people directly in the face after you've already seen other parts of them. And, you know, Riker, you've had such a reputation as a ladies' man, you know, looking at you, I don't see how. I don't know. See how functional Data really is? Okay. So Data does a search for a Dixon Hill series, and you see the big goodbye flashed on the screen. And what do you think? It makes no sense to me. So what do you think? As Data was doing his search, almost every screen that came up looked like the negative on a picture. Why wouldn't they have real pictures?
I don't know. I don't know. I have no idea.
Okay. Yeah, I just noticed that. So, I mean, the computer's flashing stuff at Data, but did you also notice it seems like what Data was seeing was just a succession of previous pictures? In other words, it was just a group of the same 10 pictures being flashed over and over and over again. And
I think they do that a lot, right?
Right, they do that a lot, but I wonder... It makes me wonder if that's the way Data processes information fast, is by repetition of picture.
So you think Data has this extraordinary ability to be able to read fast moving text,
right?
But he has to have it like 80 times,
yeah.
Otherwise he forgets it.
It makes you wonder. I mean, if he was to read an entire book from front to back. It would have to be a different page, but every time they show him flashing things, you know, maximum speed, it's the same stuff, just in over and over succession. So I'm wondering if that's the way Data would possibly read and learn that fast. So maybe I should give that a try. No.
I like what's it like. Data's a bit weird in this episode, right? He ends up going to the holodeck with Picard, Crusher, and your 20th century historian, and he kind of gets into character, you know, gets into the character of the time, and he speaks the colloquial language, and he references things, and you know, he knows stuff that even Crusher doesn't know, which you know, he's on ice and things like that,
mm-hmm.
And I don't quite see how that squares with, you know. At the beginning of the series, he didn't know what Snoop was, right? And he can't use a contraction, but he can portray a character extremely convincingly. And I don't quite see how those two things square.
Well, it was because it was after he did his computer search. And obviously, he's picking this stuff up.
So you think he just picked up, like, effectively text, spoken text, quotable dialogue.
Well,
he just throws back at the characters.
Just after the camera turned off of his reading the stuff, it put up a video of a few gangster movies. He's on ice, Bosch. Maybe that's, I don't know. It's the best I can come up with.
And I know it's silly, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's silly, but I've got a huge soft spot And I chuckled when Data's from South America.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, he's got a nice tan. And I love when they do that, when they have to explain Data's... He's kind of human-ish, but he looks a bit weird. And they do this in this episode. They do it in Time's Arrow when he's... I mean, it's in Time's Arrow when he's a Frenchman, mm-hmm. right? I love the way they just... You know, clearly Data... There's something more about Data being... Yeah, he's clearly not human. But the way they just dismiss it by referencing some ludicrous flight of fancy country... and just assuming everyone will swallow it. I always chuckle.
So what do you think would have happened if Worf had joined them? Would they have seen the Klingon ridges or just seen him as any other human?
Well, they would have... Well, I mean, by the rules of the holodeck, they probably should have seen him as any other human, but by the what seems to be followed in this episode, they would have seen him as Klingon, and that's no good, right? If you were... You know, let's say you've got a holodeck... You buy the latest installment of Dixon Hill because you're a big fan. You happen to be Klingon. You walk in to try to do, you know, try to play along with the, you know, with the game and stuff. And everyone's running, screaming away from you because they think that you're some type of, you know, demonic possessed creature that's come out of hell. I would ask for my money back.
Right. Right. I would have loved to have seen how Cyrus Redblock would have reacted to Worf. Okay. All right, so the DiMaggio streak reaches 37. Jolton Joe. Because I do want to ask this question. Since this record will stand until the year 2026 when Bob Bokai, I wonder if there's anyone that planned ahead, had a child named him Bob Bokai to get him on the Cleveland Indians so he can try and snap that record in 2026, because we're only 12 years away.
No, but Buck Bokai was on the London Kings.
Ah, yeah, that's true.
And I'm not convinced
That's right, London Kings.
There's going to be a London Kings. I mean, if it's London as in London, England, London, I really doubt there's any team likely anytime soon to be coming out of the UK.
Oh, so there's no London Kings?
Oh, no, of course not, no. I mean, we don't play baseball.
Huh. You don't?
We play cricket.
Ah.
Do you know cricket?
No.
I mean, it could be out of... It could be London, Ontario. I think that's more likely.
Could be. London Kings. That's right. I don't see anything about the London Kings. So.
No, certainly there's no London Kings.
And it's Buck Bokai. Why do I keep saying Bob? Oh, Lord. Okay. Well, that's cool. Okay, well, and I guess that record is safe for now.
It is. Or has the record been broken in reality since they filmed the show?
No, from what I understand, it stands.
Okay, great. I wouldn't know if it had been...
me either. I don't really get into baseball. So anyway, let's go on. My Mrs. Bradley is dead, and Dixon Hill is a suspect. So he's going downtown. And so obviously this is a lot of fun for Picard. And why aren't we all being interrogated? Just as Picard is detained for questioning, the Harada decide to send their death probe, I guess, which scans the ship and makes the holodeck go wonky.
Indeed.
Why would it make it go wonky? I mean,
and it goes wonky in a very weird way, right? You know, you would imagine that if something were to go wrong with, you know, a computer program or something, it would completely ruin the program. It would stop working, it would crash, and then you'd have to restart. But this is, it goes wrong, but only just enough to goes wrong so that you don't notice that it has gone wrong until someone shoots you.
Right. And when
so it's very, very specific.
When Beverly shows up, the doors are opening and closing and opening and closing. And, you know, just like yourself, you're kind of like, when you walk up to those automatic doors, you're kind of waiting for them to decide what they're going to do and then pop right in. But, of course, had we known it was a precursor to the holodeck program going wonky, I ain't going in there.
No, I would have stayed out as well.
But again, we assume the holodeck is infallible and it will work just perfect. So, but anyway, Riker tries to, pacify the Harada, and you offend us. We will not talk with a mere subordinate. End of transmission. And my stuttering wasn't off too far. So, but nothing happened there. He offended him. I mean, they set up the drastic thing that happened to the last ship that offended the Harada. And Riker offends him, I think, at least maybe once, maybe twice.
No, he certainly then tries to communicate them right at the end with them right at the end, and he gets like a screech back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know why it's.
Maybe that
he's clearly offended them.
Maybe that's it. The tape is people getting their ears bleeding. You get bleeding from the ears. Once you've seen that, you don't want to see that again. Okay. So the holo malfunction, and Riker is going to help. But of course, Wesley wants to help since Mommy's in there, and Riker takes him. How realistic do you think that is? And where's Chief Argyle?
Well, actually, we have Geordi effectively behaving once again, like the chief engineer, despite not actually being the chief engineer yet, because they've spent all their money on extras for the holodeck. What I noticed is that it's strange when Riker tells Geordi to, go and get the captain, he's in the holodeck. I mean, why do you have to go? He went down in person to the holodeck to collect him. I mean, why not just use the intercom?
Mm-hmm.
Why is there's this walk down to the holodeck? And then Geordi calls Riker and says, look, I can't find the captain. And then Riker says, I told you, he's in the holodeck. Aren't you listening? He goes, yeah, I'm in the holodeck, but I can't get in. And you think, surely there's an easier way of sorting this out without, two sets of people walking down to the holodeck and, for all intents and purposes, knock on the door and try to turn off the off switch. It's very, very peculiar. And bringing down Wesley allows Wesley, to a certain extent to save the day.
Yeah. Another thing I saw on another review of this from somebody else, a guy made a point that Data knows where the arch is. Data knows where the doors are. So what if he just made a dead run for the doors and tried to crash through them?
Now, I've never quite understood the holodeck that well, because as, you can't just run, right? And because otherwise you'd run out of space. Mm-hmm. So even if Data didn't know where it was, maybe as he runs towards the arch, maybe, the holodeck is really keeping him away from the physical wall.
Another thing. Yeah, go ahead.
Because otherwise, you would run in one direction and eventually you're kind of smack into a wall.
Right. That's another thing I was curious about is how can two people be in the same holodeck room, which really isn't all that big, looks like a 12-foot by 12-foot room. How can they be in the same room and be separated? So when he's in the interrogation room, they're out in another room. Could they hear each other? Like if Picard was to go to the street and just run, and from his point of view, he's now a mile away, could he talk and still hear Beverly? Because she's technically only 4 or 5 feet away from him.
No, indeed. And here's another question that I've just thought of. How many, when you look at the holodeck, it looks like a big world, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can walk away from people and stuff. How many people can you physically fit into the holodeck?
Hmm.
So can you fit 10,000 people into the holodeck? 70,000 people? I mean, at what point does, because the argument goes that when there are two people there, the holodeck tries to trick you by forcing perspective and stuff, so you think you're further away than you actually are. But if you just start putting more and more and more and more and more bodies into the holodeck, at a certain point, you're going to run out of physical space.
Maybe at that point, it's just nothing more than a picture of people. And it wouldn't become real until you try to walk up to those people, at which the holographic point of view would change with your movements.
I still think you wouldn't be able to handle so many, you know, so many people in one go. You know, the computer or whatever is running the holodeck would slowly get very slow and
right.
not be able to respond.
Well, my question in the Voyager would be, why is a holographic doctor's program so large that you can't have 10 or 15 doctors when his program technically fits in a little tiny mobile emitter? So if that's all his program needs is that little tiny mobile emitter, why aren't we replicating a bunch of those emitters? Why couldn't you have Denora Pell? She was able to be in the same room as Schmollis. Schmollis. Oh, man.
Well, with the mobile emitter, in fairness, was from the future.
Yes, it was.
So they perhaps couldn't quite handle it. They couldn't quite replicate or anything. But yeah, no. I mean, I think as has been already mentioned, right, the holodeck technology or the idea of the holodeck provides a way of being able to tell stories, and it's very flexible to fit whatever happens to be required of it.
Okay.
I think probably more so than any other piece of technology out there. I think that they're often, you know, okay, without mentioning the threshold or anything, but people kind of know how the warp drive works. People kind of know how phases work, and you can't just put a fastball on people. Whereas with the holodeck, you seem to have much more of a, you know, more things changed really to fit the story. And I'm relatively okay with that. I think it's, you know, you have to, the fact that they're trying to do this rather than, and you know, in my opinion, the holodeck of the original series was very often, in my opinion, when you went down to a planet that there was an exact replica of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So things like, you know, a piece of the action and Mirian things, you know, that to me was how they handled the case of, well, we've got a set from the 1950s, you know, gangster films. How are we going to be able to film on that and, you know, have a kind of gangster frolic? And I think in Next Generation, it would have been in the holodeck. In the original series, they didn't have that, so they just happened to run into a planet that was exactly the same as Boston in the Boston at the height of the gangsters.
Right. Dixon's cop friend, you know, there's a bromance going. Offers him a cigarette. Picard takes a puff on it and coughs. Why would Picard cough on a holographic cigarette?
Oh. Ah, yeah. It's clearly not holographic. It's been replicated. It must have been.
And I
like, you know, on a similar issue, that when Beverly is given the chewing gum and she swallows it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, again, we mentioned before, this is just a way of, you know, highlighting the fish out of water aspect of this. It doesn't necessarily have to make a huge amount of sense.
Right. Okay, so where they find Felix Leach? You know me, sir. He's a well-known criminal. Why would Felix Leach be so surprised that you know me, sir? You would think everybody would know him.
Yeah, or maybe people wouldn't have, you know, potentially recognized him. Maybe it's that. I like the way the Wayland does, you know, he gets quite cocky, right? And he goes up to the guy as he's holding the gun and starts saying, "You ain't gonna find nothing," and he then gets shot. And I think he's got a bit of a swagger as he goes up and confronts him that unfortunately was misplaced.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually. I think some of the one or two, I think maybe two or three of the main kind of guest stars in this episode, I think they do very well, actually. I think that the guys on the holodeck as character actors, I think they're all good. And I do like the, I'm sure they're huge stereotypes of, you know, of gangsters, and they don't really exist like this. But I found a lot of this interaction between them all to be quite fun and quite amusing.
It seems like they played Cyrus Redblock as a stereotypical Goomba wise guy. And, I don't know. It's like the Italian mob. So, anyway. But then I think he came from Brooklyn. The actor who played him, Cyrus Redblock, what's his name? Lawrence Tierney, he's from Brooklyn, so.
Okay,
so Leech wants the item. Did we ever find out what the item was?
Not if I missed it, because I don't think we did.
Okay. All right.
Now, I like as the episode is kind of drawing to an end, and basically they're trapped in the holodeck. They need to get out. They've got someone that's not taking things serious. Doesn't appreciate the seriousness of the situation, or maybe he does appreciate it, but he's trapped in the holodeck world where he's expected to be a ruthless killer. But Data and Picard start doing a weird thing where they start trying to scare the holodeck characters into some type of existential angst by saying, you, sir, do not exist.
Uh-huh.
You're just a figment of our program. And it's like, whoa, dude, stop saying this. You're scaring us. And I found that a weird thing that... why would the holograms care if you're trying to scare them with philosophy? It's a bit weird.
Right. But Picard shuts Data down when he tries to tell him, you're not real. Only about 10 seconds later says, none of us are from this world.
That is true. And really, without wanting into a huge debate, how different really is Data from the holograms? Mm. If you're going to be talking about, you, sir, are not real, you're just a projection of, your computer program and a projection of light, then... Data's not that far away, right?
No, as a matter of fact, at this point, Data has no real rights. But what do you think about Data and the lamp?
Oh, it's good. it's just well enough played, right? So that, Data's still quite a bit weird. How that, he's being written very innocent in some respect, but also he kind of fits right into character straight away, so it's a bit it's a bit weird, but I like it. He pulls the lamp out. He thinks, well, this is there's something wrong. He tries to fix it, but in reality, Picard in the background has plugged it in somewhere else. Is it Picard that plugs it in?
Yes, yeah.
But
Data thinks he fixed it because he shook it.
But then again, if he rolled back a couple of scenes, Picard doesn't know what a city block is and has to be reminded of that. So.
Yeah,
it's a bit inconsistent in a way.
Right, and I found where I put in my notes. It was because Felix asked Data where he was hatched, and he says, "I was created on a planet, Data," and then just a little bit. None of us are from this world. So
yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Picard only looks like Dixon Hill, but Data says he's a facsimile, a knockoff, a cheap imitation.
Yeah, this and also the other stuff earlier with Picard not wanting to watch the the gruesome footage. You can see that people are having fun with Data pretending to be extremely innocent in how he doesn't perceive this as being embarrassing or anything like that.
Right.
I like, by the way, right at the end, I like that there's a bit where when you do start solving the problem and you. Wesley can effectively open the door. There's a bit where they can flash over to to a snow scene.
Yes.
And the way they do that, both the fade out into the snow scene and then the fade back in when they still carry some of the snow with them, I think that's quite nicely done.
It was pretty good, yeah.
And it kind of gives a glimpse of how how crazy, frankly, the holodeck could be, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can jump from location to location and have complete control over your environment. It's that's pretty cool.
Did you notice anything when you saw some of Redblock's facial expressions? Because for some reason, I kind of thought of Thurston Howell III from Gilligan's Island.
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with that.
Gilligan's Island?
No.
Oh, wow. It's the stupidest thing that was ever created on American TV. It's about Gilligan, who's the first mate on a pleasure boat, and the captain, Grumby, I believe his name, they just call him Skipper. They take 5 passengers out for a 3-hour tour, get caught in a cyclone or something, they end up on a deserted island. And the whole thing is a sitcom about how they try and get off the island. And every time they have a rescue that could work, Gilligan finds a way to screw it up or accidentally screws it up that makes you wonder why they never killed Gilligan in the first place. But you have a millionaire and his wife, you have a Hollywood star, you have a farm girl from Kansas, I believe, and a professor who basically can make anything out of something rudimentary. So they're all stuck on this island. I mean, even things like, I think the Harlem Globetrotters show up at one time. It's so far-fetched. It's stupid. I hated the show, really. But it was pretty popular back in the 70s. 80s, maybe? So that's Gilligan's Island. You'll have to look up Thurston Howell III. So.
No, I have done so. I'm afraid I'm not aware of this.
Oh, okay. Maybe go to YouTube and find some Gilligan's Island things.
I need to be educated.
Yeah. And then I guess you don't know what the Brady Bunch is, do you?
No, I know about the Brady Bunch.
Oh, okay. Well.
But only... I suspect most of the stuff I know about it is the parodies and the stuff that they rip on, you know, from The Simpsons and stuff.
Right. Right. Okay. So anyway, back to Riker. Tries to talk to Rada again. Why not simply compose a voicemail and send it to him instead of trying to talk to him? But anyway, we come back to the program could abort and everyone inside could vanish. We've already talked about that. That's BS. Because obviously, unless a computer converts them to energy. Yeah, no. Okay. We talked about the frozen planet. Red Block and Leech decide to check out the new world, maybe plunder it, and they dissolve from the feet up. Why would it take so long to dissolve? I guess it's just enough time for him to scream out his own name. I'm Cyrus Red Block! Cyrus Red Block!
Everyone, even a holodeck character, needs a good death scene.
Mm-hmm.
As he's sitting there being vaporized, I suppose.
Yeah. So Waylon is on his way to sick bay, and it's time for the big goodbye. That's to the detective. The real goodbye, that is. Picard says he wishes he could take him with them. So that there says to me it's an official bromance.
Indeed.
Okay. But, well, you know, he asks, will my wife and kids be waiting for me when I get home? Who knows? We'll have to ask Professor Moriarty later.
Yes.
So let's see if I can do this officially. It's klaxon leash blach blanach nich kanich at Joshua rush drush Joshua. What do you think? Did I honor them or did I piss them off?
So where did he get that from? What did he just make that up?
No, that's exact. When he did the greeting, I wrote it down word for word as I could best, as I thought it sounded like. So I wrote it down.
I was just trying to see whether or not it's spelled out phonetically on memory alpha or something.
You know, I don't think it is.
No, I don't think it is either. I'm looking at it and I'm just taken aback that he managed to get all of that down.
Well, it took me about 5 or 6 times of listening to it. But, yeah, that's what it sounded like. Klaxon, leash.
Then I think they would have been impressed.
Oh, I don't know. I got a feeling I would have been de-pants, spanked, inverted, inside out, blown in my face. I don't know. That would have pissed him off somehow. So then Data does his sound to describe the experiment. Picard cuts him off. It was raining by the bay. A hard rain. So hard that it wiped the slime off. But anyway, Picard cuts him off. And then, see, I don't get it. Data wants to tell the story. Picard cuts him off because he's being an ass, I guess. But then what does Picard tell LaForge to do?
You step on it.
Step on it. All right.
He's just hogging the limelight there. When he sat down in the captain's chair, he knew what he wanted to have. You know, he knew what he was going to say. And then he was just worried that Data was going to steal his thunder. So, Data, no, please, professional. Okay. Step on it.
Yeah, Data, you're not doing it right. Or whatever. All right, well, now it's time to give our ratings for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being terrible, the worst, and 5 being the best. I'm going to have to give this one a 2. I wasn't too impressed with it. I don't even think it's a middle-of-the-road Star Trek, because it's just so lame. Boy, this is tough. I should have thought of this ahead of time. For some reason, I did all the work on putting this together, but I didn't come up with an ending thing. I want to say 2.5 to almost 3, but... The holodeck malfunction cliche, the Wesley has to save the day cliche, there's no reason why they should have vanished if Wesley goes past the anomaly or doesn't do it right, because why then did they end up on a frozen planet and then come back? That sounds like a mistake. Well, they obviously didn't end up there. So it's not like a portal. I have to say a 2. What about you?
Okay, I've been kind of a little bit all over the place on this episode thinking about it. I'm going to give it a 3 overall. And actually, I've been kind of both up and down on that score as I've been thinking about this. I think the episode is fun in general, light fun. I think there are a lot of kind of, you know, gaping plot holes that we've spoken about. The holodeck gets a bit of a bad rap. I would say that we're probably not into cliche territory yet with the holodeck, but certainly it does become slightly more cliche than one would like in later seasons. I think that what this episode does do right, though, is that I think it puts our characters in a, you know, fish out of water scenario, and I think it shows that you can use this piece of technology that is brand new to this particular show as a storytelling device. I think it gets overused, but I do think that there's good stuff to come out of the holodeck, and it's good that we do get this episode itself stands on the holodeck as some better episodes will do in the future. So, you know, it's not a great episode. It's not a terrible episode. I enjoyed it, and I'll give it a middle of the road average 3.
Okay. One thing I would like to ask our listeners, we do get some feedback in the forums, and we get what they think about the episode and what they think of what we've done. But I would like them to give a rating on a scale of 1 to 5. So if you could start ending your feedback post with your rating, that way when we get to the feedback form, we will actually include your rating on a scale of 1 to 5. So why don't you start doing that? Send us your rating on the form.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Can this be another me?
The discovery of Data's perfect android double.
How much can you trust Data now?
Leads to a deadly game of who's who.
He's been hurt.
This is very serious.
Now, Data's evil twin plots to destroy the crew.
Back off. Go!
With the help of a lethal life force on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Okay, and join us next week as we review Data Law. And hopefully we're going to have some special guests to help us out with the review. We'll see. So, I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska.
Thanks for listening.
I'm still missing my brother from another android. Take care, and good night. All right.
my kids, by the way, they've been good. They've not killed each other, but they are so past their bedtime.
I was wondering what's going on there that I'm not hearing a thing out of them.
They are playing computer games at the moment. I think they were playing Donkey Kong when I was in there a little while ago. My wife has yet to get back.